Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, and I will try to make sense out of the nonsense and bring a little bit of sanity to your week.
This week's quote comes from President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador, who brought a little sanity to the Oval Office this week with President Trump.
Hot takes starting early. I love it.
Straight into it. He said, sometimes they say that we imprisoned thousands. I like to say that we actually liberated millions. It was such a good line about restoring law and order to the former murder capital of the world, El Salvador, that Donald Trump, of course, picked up on the marketing moment and said, oh, that's a good line. Do you mind if I steal it? Which I'm sure he will. But I thought it was like a moment of sanity about, you know, keeping the murderers at bay, which maybe we need right now.
the world's cool dictator is Kadyrov quote of the week. No, I appreciate it. It is a really good line. And we'll have reason to go back to El Salvador. I'd imagine.
Yes.
Thematically, if not physically,
right?
We hope.
I'm not Chris Van Hollen. I'm not actually going to go there.
Yeah, we'll get to that later. Ridiculous. Okay, so we're going to start with our top story this week is going to be Harvard and the showdown between the administration and America's oldest university. Our Make It Make Sense section, where we really kind of try to explain something that's been confusing or naughty in the news, is going to be the saga of Kilmer Abrego Garcia and what's going on with him as he sits in one of Senor Bukele's prisons. Our tipping point this week is going to be the Joe Rogan, Dave Smith, Douglas Murray brouhaha. And you'll have to listen to the end to get to our sunburns.
Great.
So let's start off with Harvard. Harvard this week said it will not capitulate to the Trump administration's demands, as outlined in a letter. It said instead that it will fight those demands. Stanford has sort of lined up behind it. We're still not sure what other universities will do. Columbia's kind of doesn't know what it's doing, I think, or who it is or where it is at the moment. So this is something we at The Sun have written about before. You know, I think there's a lot to disentangle here. I mean, the cutting edge of this story, Rebecca, is now the threat to strip Harvard of its tax-exempt status, which would really be an earthquake in Cambridge and in Harvard Yard. You know, the Trump administration is hitting these schools where it hurts, and that's the wallet. That's their endowments and their federal funds. Mm-hmm. So I think one way to look at this is, and I get this, is Harvard had this coming. They had plenty of opportunities to sort of get this under control. They have of late, but again, it took a lawsuit from Jewish students for them to sort of at least start to pay lip service to the need to get anti-Semitism under control. The Trump demands go much broader than that. They really have to do with how Harvard runs, what it teaches. They center on viewpoint diversity, other issues. I know you have a kind of a nuanced take, I think, on this question of government role at universities, right? I mean, what do you?
Yeah,
what
not
do you
so
sort
nuanced.
Of make
I,
of?
I hate it. I mm-hmm. I dislike it when governments tell, you know, private facilities what they can and cannot, in this case, teach or say. Mm-hmm. I think as a rule that always, you know, bounces back on the person enforcing it. In other words, right now it might feel good to say to Harvard, you know, maybe you should, you know, expel somebody who hits a kid on your campus, or maybe you should protect your own students, or maybe you should have viewpoint diversity within your own faculty. I mean, those are the list of demands is quite correct. It is what a school like Harvard, an elite academic institution, so-called, should have come up with on its own. Mm-hmm. They didn't need the government to tell them to behave like an academic institution of repute, right? But they didn't do that on their own. I don't think the remedy is for the government to then write up this list of demands that infringes upon their freedom to behave badly. Mm-hmm. I think the real remedy is for them to, if they're going to behave badly, I think the remedy is for Jews and non-Jews, this is not a Jewish issue only, although it's centered around anti-Semitism. There are plenty of kids on campus whose studies have been disrupted by this chaos, and whose general, academic, what they're paying for, they're not getting, because they are getting one side of a story, you know, in their history department and their English departments. So everybody's losing who's mm-hmm. paying Harvard tuition every year. So I think those people should leave and go somewhere where they are respected. Even if Harvard were to have complied, would I want to be in a school that begrudgingly is right. saying, okay, we'll tolerate you, but we're only doing it because there's a gun pointed to our head? And then I just want to make the other point. I sort of feel like the tax exemption is its own conversation. I think there's a reasonable debate to be had about why we are subsidizing these schools in the first place, whether they behave perfectly or imperfectly. Right. I don't know that we necessarily have to be giving billions of dollars a year to institutions with $50 billion dollar endowments. Right.
There's the classic line that Harvard and many other schools are, you know, enormous hedge funds with small liberal arts colleges attached to them.
Yes, kind of that's right. And so that's another debate that I think we should be having. And I think we should detach it from this conversation about Harvard's anti-Semitism problem. I also am very worried, to be honest, about making this about anti-Semitism. I'm also at the same time sort of semi-proud to make it about anti-Semitism, for the obvious reason that we should be fighting for Jewish students' rights, which have been clearly violated in so many ways. And on the other hand, to make this only about Jewish students seems to miss the point and make us ripe for the next administration to come into a Jewish studies department at a different school and make the same list of demands and the same threats against that institution. Right. So I don't want it done in the name of the Jews necessarily.
Right. I mean, there's no other way to put this. I mean, this is, you know, kind of affirmative action of the right. It's mandating certain kinds of representation. It's mandating certain points of view. It's really sort of trying to change the human capital nature of these schools. And conservatives were really outraged by affirmative action over decades when it had to do with race and gender, and finally won a victory at the Supreme Court, Students for Fair Admission, Harvard, outlawing the use of race as a governing idea in college admissions. And, you know, this is sort of feels like it echoes it a lot. Now, not so much the counter argument, but maybe another piece of the puzzle is, it's just astonishing to me as a Harvard alum, as someone who has lots
proud
of degrees
Harvard
from Harvard, the idea that Harvard, in its own letter from its Jewish president, Alan Garber, admitted that anti-Semitism is an issue. That is wild that in the year 2025, anti-Semitism is an acknowledged issue at American campuses. So where that goes for me, Rebecca, is that the universities have been unable to police themselves. Now, I also
unable or unwilling,
unwilling,
or some combination
unable,
of both.
Resistant. Mm-hmm. You know, so then the question becomes: if a system won't change from within, how do you get it to change from without? And so, I think you've outlined a kind of exodus mentality, right? Or just sort of abstaining, or, you know, people just don't go there. And we
vote with your feet.
Vote with your feet. We talked to Dr. Panos Canellos the other week, and sort of that's one glimmer of hope on that front. Trump is pursuing a much more brute force.
But here's another thing that I would have preferred the Trump administration to do, actually. Another pathway would have been to say, this host of problems exists. You're not going to address them. You haven't addressed them. You don't want to address them. So rather than hand them a list of demands for change that we know they're not going to comply with, I would have preferred the Trump administration to hand them a list of their civil rights infractions and then simply defund based on those civil rights infractions. But don't hand them a list of changes. And now you're in the position of being on the wrong side of the issue.
Right.
Just stop paying for the nonsense, because you have every right, according to civil rights law, to stop paying for the nonsense.
Right. I mean, one thing to sort of watch for here as this unfolds is that, you know, the administration's theory is that, you know, taking federal funding comes with strings attached. Now, that might be true in theory, but the question is, in practice, how does that act? Is that actually true, right? And can the federal government withhold those funds sort of arbitrarily, capriciously? Does it need to make that kind of documentation, right? Does it need to really create a record of saying this university is failing its civil rights obligation to Jews, which I believe Harvard is, and I believe these other schools are. Mm-hmm. And that's a case that'll be need to be made in court and maybe even up to the Supreme Court. So this is quickly, I think, going to shift from the realm of rhetoric and politics to really thorny legal questions. Can a tax exemption just be revoked? Not clear.
Yeah.
Really not
clear. I mean, that's
clear.
The interesting part, the legal, forgetting the tax exemption, just defunding the $2.2 billion, which they initially did, was that, you know, did that require some kind of basis that's in law, or right. could they just do it because you're paying for right. something, you're not getting the product yeah. you like?
I will say, on the viewpoint diversity thing, these universities have failed miserably. Harvard, I don't think at the moment, has one conservative faculty mm-hmm. member. Maybe Harvey Mansfield, maybe. Oh. He should live and be well, but he's closer to 100
yeah.
than he is yeah. to 90.
But you know, this is no surprise,
and my advisor, Ruth Weiss, who departed years ago and is now, you know, also well on. And so the diagnosis, I think, is right in a lot of cases. Right, the question is about the remedy.
I mean, the idea that we're diagnosing
and
it now is...
schools aren't going to hire more conservative faculty. Right. They're not going to conservative. They're not going to hire more moderate faculty members.
They're not even going to get rid of their DEI departments. They're going to get rid of the sign on the door that says DEI, but they're going to come up with three other letters, right? They're not going to do any of this. I don't think that comes as a surprise to anyone. We've been fighting this not just since October 7th or in the last few years. We've been fighting it for a very long time. This predates this issue about anti-Semitism and the Jews and Hamas invading Israel on October 7th. Everyone knew it. Everyone has known it for a long time, or maybe a lot of people who were involved knew it. Now, pretty much everyone knows it. Trying to fix it seems futile.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best case scenario here is that these schools come to a, and you might disagree here, come to a kind of agreement with the government where there is a sense of, we are taking a lot of this federal money. Here are some basic expectations about how campuses are run and whose voices are allowed to be heard. And then everyone can kind of move on with their life.
Even
you know?
That kind of makes me slightly squeamish because that list will change depending on administrations, and it might not always be such a healthy list.
Yeah.
But let me ask you just this basic question. My children just got into college last, you know, December.
Yeah.
I discouraged them heavily from even, we didn't even apply to mm-hmm. places like Harvard. Would you go to Harvard again now today if you were 18 years old, given what you know about the school? Is that a school you'd want to learn at?
No, not at the moment, but that's why I really do want it to get better. If the funding issue becomes the kind of Archimedean lever mm-hmm. to sort of get it to a little bit of a better place, I'd be happy. I mean, you know, I don't trust these schools to do it on their own.
I don't trust them to do it at all. So there we go.
Okay. Make it make sense. Sexton.
Back to El Salvador we go.
Right.
You mentioned Kilmar Obrego Garcia, mm-hmm. Who was removed from the country. The great, did you call it a brouhaha, mm-hmm. I think, that ensued, mm-hmm. is still going on. And I just wanted to talk through some of the legal questions surrounding this. And it's, you know, sort of separate and distinct, but related to the political questions, which we can get into afterwards. But just technically, legally, as I understood it, there was a withholding order that Garcia could not be sent back specifically to El Salvador, but he did have deportation orders mm-hmm. from an immigration court and then from the appellate court. So he was deportable. Mm-hmm. That should be made clear, correct? Mm-hmm. And he was sent, the Trump administration says it was an administrative error, a clerical error, that he was sent back to El Salvador into that prison. But he's there. And Bukele has said, President Bukele, that he will not return him. And then when the Supreme Court chimed in, they said that the Trump administration should facilitate his return, but didn't have to effectuate mm-hmm. his return, which was in the initial order by the district court. And I wanted to start with those two words with mm-hmm. you.
Sure.
What do they mean? Are they designed to mean nothing so that we don't, neither side has to mm-hmm. actually follow up?
Right.
What does it mean to effectuate versus facilitate this man's return? And the Trump administration has very cleverly said, well, we would facilitate, mm-hmm. but we can't. What's the point of that whole language?
I mean, the order from the district court judge was facilitate and effectuate. And I think without parsing it, you know, to the point of nonsense, I think the basic idea is effectuate is stronger, right? Effectuate is to kind of, is to affect some, is to make something
proactively
happen.
Do something.
Exactly. Facilitate seems to be helping something that's already in the works.
It's reactive.
Exactly. And importantly, the Supreme Court only picked up on facilitate, right? So they dropped effectuate and reminded the judge of the deference owed the executive branch. So it was I called it in a piece I wrote, a cryptic ruling, a mysterious ruling, and returned the case to court.
Mysterious by design?
By design, I think the court was sort of not yet ready to really weigh in. I think it wanted to see how things played out. Remember, this case is sort of still ongoing. It's unusual for the court to even hear a case at this point or to reach down and issue an opinion. You know, the administration has changed their story here. I mean, they said in court that this was a mistake, and now they said it's not a mistake.
Drill down on what specifically they claim the mistake to have been, that he was sent to El Salvador as opposed to Timbuktu?
Well, that the proper procedures for deportation weren't followed. I mean,
he didn't have a warrant.
Yeah, he was just sent without any of those kind of processes being
fulfilled.
But
wouldn't the prior deportation order and the appellate court's upholding of that deportation order be the due process that he was owed?
But there still was the order on the books barring him from being deported to El Salvador. Right.
So it feels like the mistake was the location to which he was deported.
Yeah. I mean, he could be deported somewhere else, you know. This is another one of those cases where I just think there's a way forward here for the administration to get what they want. I mean, they can bring him back and then deport him somewhere else. Mm-hmm. It's almost become now a point of principle where you have, you know, in the Oval Office, Trump and Bondi and Bukele all saying we're not going to do it. You know, it feels juvenile to me. I mean, if you make a mistake, it's okay. Just do it. No one's saying he has to stay in this country if he's met the standards for deportation.
Well, some of the Democrats are sort of claiming that he's innocent.
Yeah. I'll get to that in my sunburn, but I think there's a middle position here. And remember, there are lots of ways to deport someone back to their home country. Right. I mean,
he didn't have to go to the prison.
He didn't have to go to the prison. Right. It's not clear exactly the gang membership issue. Has that proven? Has that not been proven in court? I think there's a lot up in the air about that.
It was signed off on by the judges in those courts. They agreed that he was determined to be a member of MS-13, although they themselves didn't dig into the details.
Right.
But at least from a legal perspective, I would say that's covered.
Yeah.
I think it's also interesting that if that's the big objection, that he was sent back to the country that he was not supposed to be sent back to, not that he was deported at all, such a strange case for the Democrats to be launching on, because, you know, he's not an innocent Maryland dad. And this idea of sticking on that one relatively small legal point.
Well, I think part of it is the fact that the administration is on record saying this was a mistake, right? And so the natural question then is, well, just fix it, right? I mean, the refusal to fix it.
Yeah.
Now, this does happen at the sort of intersection of foreign policy, immigration policy. And as we sort of seem to be forming this really close relationship with El Salvador. And I don't think that's anything anyone could have really predicted. It's a really interesting emerging bilateral relationship.
Yes.
I think more and more these questions are going to come up of sort of what applies extraterritorially, what applies in El Salvador. And as these prisons are going to be more and more used almost as kind of like, holding areas, you know, I wonder if this is going to be an emerging body of law, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Is it almost feels like an extension of a domestic prison at this point. And Bukhari has said he's going to increase capacity, and Trump is on board with that. So, it seems to me, you know, in the past when we have deported people by mistake, we've compensated them, we've tried to make it right. I don't love the idea of someone, no matter how horrible, just being where they shouldn't be. There's something about that. It's not a matter of being soft-hearted. It's a matter of like, there was a legal error made here.
Do you think that the SCOTUS ruling is going to deter future district courts from trying to interfere in these cases, or the opposite?
Well, SCOTUS is going to rule. SCOTUS is going to rule again. And the question now is, lots of questions. One is, will the district court judge try to mirror the Judge Boasberg in initiate contempt orders to force the government to bring him back? Will the Supreme Court risk ordering that with the knowledge that it might well not happen? Then sort of what situation do you have? But I agree that this is a case where kind of like, it's not exactly a perfect clean case of sort of like a totally innocent person or a totally guilty. It's a strange kind of crossed wires, mm-hmm. Misaligned sort of fact pattern.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
The other thing to say, you know, is that, you know, Trump has promised massive deportations, and you know, he's going to test the ability of people's stomachs. If there are to be that level of deportations, mistakes are going to be made. And I think this is part of the bigger stakes of this issue is, did people who supported him on immigration, which is the majority of Americans and still remains his most popular issue, do they have, you know, will they kind of stick by this broader plan as these kinds of errors crop right. up?
Well, and practically, I'm sort of wondering legally, how do you deport all of those people if each one needs to have a court yeah. date, and you don't have enough judges and you don't have enough immigration right. courts? Is President right. Trump going to have to build a whole immigration court infrastructure that we currently don't have and fill it with judges and get yeah. the ball rolling here? And is everybody yeah. going to get their own day in
yeah.
court here?
Yeah. Well, this has been an issue for a long time. Is one of the issues with the immigration problem is a lack of administrative law judges, of immigration courts, of the ability to hear asylum, all those things. There's none right. of that infrastructure. So that's a generational problem. But, you know, the Supreme Court in the Alien Enemies Act case, the Trinidad, it did say, even as they supported President Trump's ability against Judge Boasberg, they supported his ability to deport people under the Alien Enemies Act, mm-hmm. at least for now. They said this is sort of an invasion. You know, they did say you have to give him process.
Right.
And that unanimously.
Process is different for those under the Alien Enemies Act than it would be for just a regular
right.
illegal
person. Right,
but
it probably has to do with a basic hearing. It probably has to do with an ability to present evidence. You probably are entitled to a lawyer. I mean, it's not a full trial, but that's kind of what process means. Mm-hmm. And you're right about the question of scale and process. To a large extent, process constitutionally is meant to slow things down. Right. That's the idea
right.
that if I'm accused of something, I'm not just right. convicted. I can exercise my rights along the way.
It's also really interesting to me that, you know, the Democrats, of course, pick this moment politically yeah. and Chris Van Hollen does them no favors by, you know, flying to El Salvador and grandstanding yeah. and all that silliness. But yeah. it feels like another losing issue for them to be yeah. making their issue. But interestingly to me, it also feels like a danger to Republicans. Because right now we're talking about, you know, gang members and rapists and murderers. And so public sentiment is, mm-hmm. well, even if you made a mistake about this issue, he's still a bad guy.
Yeah.
I don't really care. When it starts becoming about people whose crime is that they came here illegally, which is a crime, mm-hmm. Don't have records and haven't been bad
yeah.
citizens or non-citizens, there's going to be a whole other conversation. And it feels like we're making this all about criminal, the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
But Republicans might be doing damage then to their next argument about not the worst of the worst when it comes time to try deporting some of them.
Yeah. Or that, you know, these things, a lot of these things are about optics and, you know, Christine Noem in her, you know, camouflage gear. And, you know, so I think there's a sense of theater.
She had that in her closet.
Obviously. Yeah. So do I. I think that's a, you know, that's a fair point. I think another danger of this is that, you know, it sort of obscures the success Trump has closing the southern border, which has been really astonishing. So there's a little bit of, I think, a question of, you know, how do you, as you pursue these more kind of edge cases, you know, are you neglecting to maybe sell the point of like, overall, you know, the immigration situation is better. I'm totally with you about, you know, Chris Van Hollen flying to El Salvador and, you know, calling him Kilmar, you know, first name. And, you know, and evidence now has come out that he beat his wife. And,
yes.
You know, I mean, you know, it's a strange show to die on. I mean, you know, I'd love to see similar efforts go to, you know, fly to Gaza, try to, you know, whether it's Cory Booker or Chris Van Hollen. I mean, yeah.
Always super interesting. I think that the withholding order initially that prevented him from being deported to El Salvador, I think one of the reasons given was that a rival gang would threaten his life, which would suggest if you have a rival gang, then you're in a gang.
Right.
So almost in the order.
Occam's razor.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
No, he was just wearing that sweatshirt because he liked it and hanging out with other MS-13 members because they're his friends.
Go Bulls.
Right. Yeah. Right. All right. Did we make that make sense? I don't know, but we tried.
We tried.
Okay. Tipping point time. Mm-hmm. This was actually the brouhaha. I misspoke earlier. This was your brouhaha between Douglas Murray and Dave Smith on the Joe Rogan podcast. Douglas Murray was invited on to talk about his latest book, the title of which I'm forgetting now, something like Democracies and Death Cults.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. They were going to debate. He was there to promote his book, but then also Dave Smith was brought in to sort of debate the Israel Gaza situation. Dave Smith, of course, I think he describes himself as a libertarian, a left leaning libertarian. And Douglas Murray has been very supportive of Israel, particularly after October 7th.
The book, I think, is his reporting from Israel, you know, in the wake of
October
7th.
A great amount of time there, a subject which came up during this brouhaha. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of reactions to it, and I want to hear what you thought. My initial thought, I was actually excited about it because very rarely do we have on podcast conversations that go back and forth point for point with people who just fundamentally disagree. Mm-hmm. Usually get one person on, you listen to everything they say, you might be compelled by it, but then you don't really have a way to counter anything that they've said, and then you have to go and listen to someone else. Mm-hmm. I like just the idea of having people debate it out. It's not done enough.
Right.
So that was sort of hopeful, but they didn't really end up talking much about the details. There was some conversation about intentional killing of children in Gaza, and there was definitely conversation about Dave Smith's very unfortunate and I think probably deliberate use of the word concentration camp to describe the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
But
that's an old like Norman Finkelstein,
out of that book.
Noam Chomsky, yeah.
So there wasn't enough on the details. It was mostly about the substance. And the big, you know, brouhaha was really about, and social media was about Douglas Murray's sort of presentation of himself as an expert on these issues and Dave Smith's contention that, you know, expert doesn't mean what it used to mean post-COVID era. And why do I have to have gone there in order to have had an opinion? And that went back and forth. And I'm sort of left with this. Expert does have a different meaning after the COVID era. People don't relate to that word in the way that they used to, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. A lot of experts let us down in multiple domains. On the other hand, I think it's also important to remember that being a non-expert doesn't make you an expert in today's world. Right. And I think we've turned that corner.
Yeah.
The less of an expert you are, the more of a comedian who's really smart and well-read you are, it seems to make you our hero now. And we listen to you because the other guy who's been doing this for a living must be wrong. And I think that's equally dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be careful about who we listen to and why, and the kind of information we take in and how much credibility we give people.
Yeah. No, I think that's very well put, Rebecca. I, you know, there's, I think what Douglas was getting at was there are this emerging class of or arrived class of people with huge social media followings who are espousing objectively what I think are awful points of view. Hear it in sort of playing footsies with Holocaust revisionism. You hear it in extreme anti-Israel rhetoric. It was on that, I forget who it was, but who went a couple months ago on Tucker Carlson.
Daryl Cooper,
just got a big Times profile of him a couple days ago and said Churchill's the bad guy in the war. You know, this kind of provocative, trollish, mostly men, but not only. You can throw in Candace Owens whoever you'd like. And I think what Douglas was trying to do was get some altitude and say, this isn't about this specific claim about Rafah, or it's not about did Israel bomb this hospital or not, or is this, keeping the Netzarim corridor justified or not. It's more this broader on the level of discourse is kind of who has credibility, who has trust, and who doesn't. And by and large, these people don't, or they don't. Now, fair enough, right? I mean, I think that's true. I mean, would I trust, Andrew Roberts, one of the preeminent World War II Churchill historians, or Daryl Cooper? That's obvious.
Daryl wouldn't even debate Andrew Roberts and cited the fact that Andrew Roberts was the expert in that field.
And I'm with you about the wariness of making it, though, about expertise rather than the specific claims. I don't love that idea in any case. I don't love when people say, I'm not an expert, I can't have an opinion.
Right.
That drives me bananas in social settings all the time. I'll be talking about the news and I'll say, hey, what do you think about this? I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
I don't feel like an expert either. I just
you kind of are.
Maybe, but that's the point is I want voices to come in that aren't pre-screened, that don't have to, have a resume, attached to them. And it just, I didn't find that super compelling.
Right.
Because it's a policing of who's in the conversation as opposed to an engagement with what's within the conversation.
Agreed. And I think that point was proven after Daryl Cooper went on the podcast and made those claims about Churchill. I forget who had, it might have been Uncommon Knowledge. Mm-hmm. One of the podcasts had on Andrew Roberts, Niall Ferguson, and Victor Davis Hanson, three of the top historians of our time, who went point by point through each of his contentions, might have been Piers Morgan, I'm forgetting now, and disproved his contentions based on their understanding of history and gave the counterpoint. To me, that's the best solution, not to silence Daryl Cooper, but to have on people who can point directly to where he is misguided and wrong, which is, I think, what Dave Smith was saying he was trying to do back and forth with Douglas Murray, although I don't give him that much credit. I didn't see him really trying to do that. I think there Douglas Murray did have a point that there was some other motive.
Yeah. And where I agreed with Douglas was when he said, listen, you know, it's not you're saying I'm just bringing it up or I'm just asking questions. No, I mean, the flip side of saying that expertise is not necessary is that if someone does enter the conversation, they are to be held to a reasonable. They don't get a discount for that.
Correct.
Right. Like you can't have it both ways. You can't both want to speak. And then when you do say, oh, I don't know, I'm just sort of raising questions. I mean, that's a pernicious rhetorical move.
Yes.
Right. To say, oh, I don't know, maybe so many Jews weren't killed in the Holocaust. I'm just raising a question.
Right. I read it in Haaretz, so maybe, but I'm not saying it's me.
Right. Yeah. I think that's bad. But on the other hand, we were just talking about universities, Rebecca, and the collapse of universities or the compromising of the academia, which historically has been the place of expertise. And so, I don't necessarily trust academics to be authorities nowadays either on this. And a lot of the anti-Israel stuff and just is coming from people with very fancy titles and degrees. It's not Dave Smith. It's people with chairs. It's people with lots of letters after their name.
Yes.
And so, you know, now you can say, well, they're not experts in what we're talking about, but a lot of times they have the credentials. I want to make it about the substance. I want to make it about the truth. I want to make it about, you know, reality.
And this is the place we find ourselves in the world of technology that we live in, and the post-COVID era, I keep going back to where trust was broken. We don't really have a fix for this yet. We don't really know who we're trusting and why we're trusting people and what the mechanism is by which we're going to decide.
If someone on X says, I have a PhD, it's like the worst. Like if they introduce what they're
saying. You say you have a degree from Harvard, I kind of believe you less, right? So you might want to drop that from your resume. But no, really, that's the point.
But as part of the argument. I mean, a lot of times people will chime in and say, hi there, PhD here in Middle East
studies.
Worst.
We've all been on those blind dates.
It's off.
Nobody wants to hear that in the resume. Yeah. But I think that the larger point is we're overcorrecting by now going to the anti-expert, which we shouldn't do. Yeah. And I don't think we have the mechanism yet by which to figure out where the center is on this question of who to trust and what credentials they should or shouldn't have that would allow us to trust them and should compel us to trust them. We're all just trying to figure that out as a society. And I think this interview was the perfect example of that struggle that we're all going through.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. The idea of an issue like, let's just be specific. I mean, the idea of the Israel issue has become such an issue in society at large that everyone does have an opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the nature. It's the most viral of topics. Mm-hmm. And that means there's going to be a lot of stupidity. And I don't think being wary of an argument of expertise means you can't call out stupidity. But it means no one has a monopoly on stupidity, just like there's no monopoly on wisdom.
Yes. Okay, sunburn time. I feel like we're already revved up. So do you want to go first?
Yeah. My sunburn is, it's more a sun. It's a sunburn. And that is what is going on with these Iran negotiations. Mm-hmm. I'm totally baffled. For years, I heard critiques from the right about the Obama deal, about, you know, muzzling Israel. And it appears as if Trump is doing the very same thing. Witkoff went on TV and seemed to allow for development of nuclearization as long as it wasn't military, or I don't even really knew if he knew what he was saying, and then sort of backed off. Some reporting last night indicates that Trump has stayed Israel's hand because of divisions in the administration. This is now an old story, and I don't mean to say that Trump is unique this way in terms of being skeptical of a military strike, but it does, I think, cut it a worry I've had for a while, and that there are sort of isolationist elements within this administration that I think will be heard from and are being heard from. And maybe there's a little bit point here on the expertise point, you know, is maybe some of these guys are in a little bit over their head. And for sure, the old Iran hands and foreign policy hands sort of didn't distinguish themselves. I'm not saying we bring back Jake Sullivan to run our foreign policy, but it's been a little bit amateur hour the last few days. And I just hope that Jerusalem and Washington kind of get on the same page, and that whatever happens, it's done hopefully with a united front and with a shared sense of purpose.
Nice. Okay. I can agree with that. Speaking of amateur hour, my sunburn is New York State Attorney General Letitia James.
Oh, great. Okay.
Oh, it's almost too easy. I apologize, but I couldn't let it go by. It's not even the fraud that she is alleged to have committed, trying to procure better mortgages and bank loans and listing her father as her husband, not once but twice on two separate bank documents and all that. And it's not even the shameless hypocrisy of being guilty of sort of the same basket of things that she spent years pursuing Donald Trump for, and I think, falsely He is not really guilty of what she said he did, and she herself appears to me to be very guilty of what she was pursuing him for. But those things bother me actually less than her response after the referral for was made against her. She got on TV and she was speaking at something. She was at the podium. It was a very short little speech she gave in which she sort of invoked, I don't know, like if Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson had a baby, it would have been her at that microphone. Sort of with her.
I don't really want to imagine.
I know. Sorry for the mental image, everyone. But
adopted.
The tone, the fire and brimstone, sort of Baptist church, you know, insult to proper Baptist pastors. The way in which she responded, and she invoked all the things that one could imagine she would invoke, right? She talked about, I'm a graduate of Howard University. She invoked Thurgood Marshall's name, segregation being dismantled in her role in that, as if she were doing like a BLM kind of fist in the air, I defy you because the color of my skin, completely detached from the reality that this entire country, including people with her same skin color, we have rejected this racialist identity politics nonsense over and over again, and that for that reason, it's one of the reasons that Donald Trump was reinstalled as president of the United States, because people like her have been playing these pernicious games having to do with race and using it as an excuse for everything, including her own just base criminal behavior. For that, she is my sunburn of the week, for bringing us all down with that ridiculous response. And if these allegations are true, and they certainly look to me like they are, I hope that the full weight of the justice system falls on her in the same way she promised to use it against President Trump.
Okay, Rebecca, thank you. We'll see you next week.
See you next week, Ari.